Thanks, Jane. That was great, and Baron, for walking through the your proposal. What I want to do now is turn to Woody, who I'm sure will agree violently with everything you've just heard. Maybe not, but more seriously, what I'm interested in is definitely Woody getting your reactions, and having read your recent op-ed in the LA Times, maybe you can focus in on what you see it from a privacy perspective as the bigger threat, the private sector having these data or government, and then how do you deal with the fact, and this came out in Jane and Baron's talk, with the idea that there are likely to be private initiatives regardless, and what role is it? Does it make sense in some ways to have the government sitting on top of it rather than having a bunch of pockets of private? We can talk about that with the whole panel as well. But I just wanted to put a little on the plate since we're running out of time. And Woody, the floor is yours.
Sure. Thanks so much. I appreciate the opportunity. And we actually, I with respect to your comment, I think that I actually end up agreeing with a lot more than you might think about the way in which we should think about privacy here. I think that Jane and Baron and their co-authors' concerns about the effectiveness of the contact tracing app are pretty valid in that it seems like there are some sort of limitations. And I think that it is important to think about privacy outside of only the concept of informed consent, which is a concept that I've been critical of as well, because I don't think it scales. And I think that it's not the only sort of privacy-related value that we should bring to bear here. And I actually do think that there are conceptualizations of privacy that can actually accommodate public health and the information that's needed. And HIPAA is actually a relatively good model of some of how that can work. And in research that I've done with Neil Richards, he advocated for thinking about privacy in terms of trust and trust-related rules that can actually help us facilitate the exchange of information in some of these important relationships that we have with public health authorities. For the purpose of my comments, I'd like to just sort of leave aside questions over that I think many people will probably have about efficacy of the proposal. I'd like to assume sort of the efficacy for the purpose of argument, and also questions about the allocations of resources in this versus other alternatives. And so I want to put that to the side. And I would really like to focus on the fact, two things. One is the real sort of revolutionary nature of not only what is being proposed, but also what is potentially necessary. And in that sense, I'd like to make two observations. One, privacy law wasn't really up to the task before the pandemic. And so for something this revolutionary, I would feel a whole lot better if we had something in much better working shape before we actually got started on this. And certainly, I don't think it's up to the task, as we see it now, in such a ambitious and dramatic expansion of surveillance infrastructure and data capabilities. And a lot of the reason why I think privacy law is not up to the task right now is because a lot of US data privacy law, and in Europe, is actually based upon this choice model, right? The idea that we should further informational self-determination, which of course I think is just one of many different ways of effectuating privacy values. I won't take up too much time talking about it, though I could talk about it at length because I'm working on a paper on it right now. But I'll simply say that there are other models, relational models of privacy that exist that we could draw from. Neil and I have proposed a turn to trust along with Ari Waldman, that also is in harmony with a lot of the proposals around information fiduciaries that have made its way into several bills in Congress and at the state level. And so I'll offer that up as a way of putting forth a proposal that if we were to embrace something as revolutionary, as potential as what's needed now, we would need something equally revolutionary in privacy law that I think could accommodate this, but also preserve a lot of important notions of privacy. But that's actually not what scares me the most. What scares me the most about this entire thing is the idea that is the long-term consequences of embracing such a dramatic expansion of these sort of surveillance capabilities. This is definitely a shifting of risk, right? So a lot of what we're talking about is there's risk on one side, there's risk on the other. When we create this massive database, we shift risks. But this, from what we know, when you have to move fast and create these systems very quickly, which presumably we want to do, there is going to be a lot of error, which we would anticipate. But one of the things I really worry about is, A, the way that these systems will be deployed outside of what we think of as the traditional privacy barriers. So to address what you sort of mentioned earlier, is this going to affect the way in which we actually interact with each other, with our relationship with our employers, with our relationship with physical spaces? And there's a lot of unknowns there that makes me nervous. But what makes me even more nervous is the level of opportunism that is inherent in such an ambitious project. So governments are inherently going to probably want to keep this sort of surveillance infrastructure around. And I really know Shannon Barron's point that they want to sort of end this as soon as possible. But what we know from history is that there's a strong surveillance inertia that happens when we lay this infrastructure. And so I worry about governments co-opting it. I worry about the level of opportunism that industry also might play in this. So you might have a tech giant sort of coming in saying, this is a great opportunity. Why don't we provide sort of free data access, right? We can have zero rating along with the apps and the phones that are distributed. And there's a lot of room for opportunism, which then could potentially lead to abuse. And so I worry about not having the protections that we would need to prevent that kind of opportunism. And then the final thing that I worry about, and then we can get to questions and we can move on, is the thing that seems almost inevitable is that even if we have interest in place to have this be a temporary solution, is that this is not going to get rolled back. We've been fighting the war on terrorism for how long now? The war on drugs for how long now? We're still re-upping the Patriot Act's provisions that had sunset clauses in them, and potentially it's even getting worse. And so one of the things that makes me nervous is that we would over-rely upon the temporary nature of this, when what's more likely to happen is that this will permanently change our norms. It will create a massive amount of inertia moving forward. And so that's why I would really want to see a revolutionary change in privacy law to accommodate the long-term implications of this, because it seems to me that just by history, if it's anything, that it's almost impossible to go back to the way we were. I do think that privacy and public health can coexist, and if we have the right approach to this, then they can actually support each other. And I'll leave it at that.
Thanks a lot, Woody. That was great. Before we return to audience questions, I would like to go back to Dan. Number one, we haven't heard you kicked everything off, and we haven't given a chance to react to any of this. And the one question I would put maybe more directly in, and you can react to it, or react to other things you've heard, Dan, is it does, you know, both Woody's talked about it, and Barron and Jane talked about it, is that we, regardless of whatever sort of government initiative we end up with or don't end up with, they're likely to be private firms who are, as Woody said, it's going to change our relationship with our employer, with retailers. You know, we may need to have the app. I read an article this weekend in the Wall Street Journal about that in certain office buildings, you would have an app and they would look at tracing. They kind of do their own little pockets of testing and tracing within private sector. What question I have for you, Dan, is how does that provide any efficacy, a whole bunch of pockets of little of testing and tracing throughout the economy, but not centralized? Is there any, does that help us drive the R not down, or is it counterproductive, or so anyway, I'd be interested in getting your thoughts on that and anything else that's been put on the table since you kicked us off.
Sure. Thank you. The thing that I would point everybody back to, and you can jump back through the slides on your own, I won't take the time to pull them up again, is that curve about the final seroprevalence that's achieved given an RO. And it gets very, very flat at the top. And so you can take an RO of 6 and reduce it down to 3 and get almost no movement at all. You can get an RO of 3 and reduce it down to 1.5, and you get very modest payoffs. And so these kind of one-off type actions taking place with individual businesses or universities, it doesn't hurt. It certainly helps. But all of the payoff in ending an epidemic comes when you break that R not. And so we're faced, I think, with two really untenable choices. To either let this epidemic burn at full speed by, reopening in spite of the consequences, or being in a situation of in the economic disaster that results if we stay locked down. We're looking at a period in excess of a year, possibly 2 years before we're in a situation where we're likely to have a vaccine that provides a solution. And I think it's unimaginable that either of the things that we face, letting this burn at full force, or neither choice is good. And so we need some kind of solution that breaks that barrier.
Thanks, Dan. In the interest of time, I know we could have a big discussion among all of us, but we have developed a little bit of a queue here on questions, and I know we're right up against noon. And if it's, I know, I don't think we're going to be kicked off of this WebEx channel for a while. So if the panelists are able to stick around, I believe they are for a little while, I'll try to get to some of these questions. And as I said, I'll call on you, and then we can unmute you, and you can ask your question to the panelists. And in the interest of time, and because of technological limitations, we just ask that you. After you've done your question, we'll put you back on mute. There unfortunately won't really be time for much of a back and forth or follow-up. So the first person I have in the queue is Carolyn Signorelli. Apologies if I'm butchering your name. So if you are still online and have a question, then you'll be unmuted and you can ask it of the panelists.
Hi. Thank you for the presentation. I guess my question is really about how realistic it is that we're going to get something this universal and comprehensive up and running. I presume the expectation is that the federal government is going to have to kind of get behind this to a certain extent. So I guess my question is, how realistic is it that we can accomplish this given what we're looking at with our administration and the Senate?
Baron, do you want to take that one?
Yeah, so think of it this way. There is a deployment. It would be really good to get those 19% of Americans on board, and we think it's worth spending every penny it takes to do that. We also think that giving smartwatches is well worth the money. That requires money and time and logistics to really get everyone on board. But those are marginal improvements. What we're proposing here could be done more or less with the flip of a switch. The only reason that Google and Apple have not done so is that they, very understandably, and I think appropriately, as private corporations, have decided that it's not appropriate for them to opt people into a system like this. What they need is a legal mandate that requires them to do this, but also puts in place the kind of privacy safeguards that we have proposed. So the way to think about the question here is really what would it take to get legislation passed? That bill, in essence, is not that complicated. And that could be done very quickly, even if the program to maximize deployment takes some time to implement.
And, you know, I would like to add, I think I took the essence of the question to be, you know, is there a political will to do something this dramatic? And I would say today, realistically, no. But we are going to see, outbreaks continue in the U.S. And as Dan said, we're going to, I think, come to terms with the fact that this, you know, a vaccine is not going to be here in September. And so there will be building political will because the other options are too costly. And so, you know, Baron and I and the group of us and anyone who wants to join us, please come reach out to us, are trying to prepare for that, so that there's something ready to go when we come to realize that this is.
And I will just add that France and the UK are already moving towards a system that looks something like this. Germany made some signs of doing so, but the Germans backed off because of the privacy reaction. And that's why we as privacy lawyers are really focused on trying to get people, as Woody said, to stop equating privacy with do I opt in or not. Privacy means so much more than that. It means who is my information shared with? Is it shared with people who don't need to see it? The South Korean system, in that sense, is a good model. There are ways to protect privacy that can let us live, that can make a system like this work. It just requires that we think more creatively about this and stop assuming that privacy means that you opt in at every step of the way.
So next up on my list of questions is from Jeannie Barton. So Jeannie Barton, you are up.
Okay, thank you very much, and thank you for the presentation. And Woody, thank you for your thoughtful comments on it. I think actually the economic consequences of as well as the health consequences are going to make it possible in a few months to entertain this more realistic option. And I also think that Woody's views about a different model of privacy could be incorporated into a movement to get legislation that would make this not only possible, but make it work and make it happen. So my question is, how can we all educate to get this kind of logic out into policy and media thinking where it has been noticeably absent?
Sure. I mean, I think that it's worth probably drawing on examples where we have privacy, but we don't necessarily think about them in terms of privacy. So the relationships that we have with people, you know, your doctor, for example, or public health authorities that are bound by lots of different rules and norms. We feel safe disclosing things to them, but we often don't think about that in terms of privacy because so much of privacy is often thought of in these terms of either secrecy or control, right? And so it's going to take a lot, and it's going to require us to buck the sort of traditional way of doing things, which we've been. I mean, even the bills that are being proposed now are still firmly rooted in this idea of sort of informational self-determination, I guess taking our appeal to the public also would help. That's a really good question.
Jane, Baron, or Dan, anyone want to add anything, or I'll go to the next person in the queue?
I would just add that I agree that trust, building trust, is going to be an important, critical part of public acceptance. But I also think that this, you know, if there is a legal mandate for Apple and Google to dump data into some sort of central reservoir, the privacy rules can be managed such that the real trust exercise is not between people and Google and Apple, but rather between people and the CDC or the public health authorities of their states. And for those, there actually is a pretty high degree of trust right now and understanding and goodwill, especially for, you know, governors. So it might be worth figuring out how to minimize the, you know, the participation of Apple and Google except for collecting and providing data.
Well, I want to be really clear here. In our system, Apple and Google do not collect data. It does not go to their servers. They do not have access to it. We are not talking about a pipeline from Apple and Google to the CDC. What we're talking about is them enabling features on their individuals' phones that allow that data to go to the CDC database. So in that sense, Google and Apple don't gain anything here. And we think, given that technological structure, which is essentially the structure that the Apple-Google system uses today, except that it sends information directly to the CDC, we think that it's more than adequate to address the potential for abuse along the way through legislation. And I understand Woody's frustration. It's been 20 years since the Federal Trade Commission first asked for privacy legislation. I want to see it passed. So does Woody. I suspect if we got together in a room, we could probably work something out. It would be better to do that with this, but this cannot wait for that to be resolved. I think that Woody's concerns could be addressed in legislation that is specific to this program and that governs the potential for abuse here by any actors that get information, which is primarily going to be people who get it from the CDC database and how the public health authorities make use of that data. This is really not about Google and Apple, even though it sounds like it is. Their role here, again, is just to be mandated to enable the phones or smartwatches to send that data to the CDC and then to be restricted from making any use of that data off of the phones themselves.
And can I just add one thing that there's so much, there's a sort of larger narrative going on here that's going to be critical to a response generally, which is so much of the success of any of these kinds of initiatives are going to be dependent upon reinvesting supports and confidence and resources into our public institutions and a commitment to expertise, which is going to be critical if we're going to foster that trust.
Thanks. Let me next go to Dahlia Ritvo. Again, apologies if I'm butchering the name, but you are next up on the queue if you're still there.
Thanks for the presentation. As you have all alluded to, the efficacy of anything like this is primarily relying on trust, and trust now is low, particularly when you use names like Google and Apple. Limited polling shows that this is the case, and then there is a mistrust of government use of data. You guys mentioned scope creep and sunset provisions not really working and things like that. So the question I have is, let's say you get the public will, you get the legislation, all that happens. How do you make sure that people don't just leave the phones at home? The problem with mandatory element to me seems, unless you're literally putting bracelets that people can't pull off of themselves, they still have the option of turning their phones off or leaving them at home. And I see that there is a strong possibility that many may do that due to lack of trust in government more broadly, not necessarily the CDC or their local health agency, a lack of understanding of privacy laws and how they're protected or not protected, and a lack of understanding of infrastructure that protects their privacy, specifically thinking that Google and Apple are getting all of this data and using all this data and amassing it for who knows what purposes. So understanding this is a big PR campaign as much as it is a legal and technical one, what do you guys suggest to address that problem?
So I'll step in if that's okay. I actually am not as confident about the premise of the question because under the stress of COVID-19, to target this particular problem, public opinion actually is not what you might expect. So, you know, Pew has done surveys and also at University of Washington did a survey suggesting that we're already at the point where more than half of the people would be comfortable with data on their you know, geolocation or, you know, the questions vary, but with that sort of data being accessed and used for public health purposes. And as a practical matter also, I this is a system that is not quite as trust oriented. So I agree that sometimes people are going to leave their phones and just, you know, the marginal efficacy losses from that will be something, maybe non-trivial. But to walk onto a university campus, to go into your Trader Joe's, to go to your place of employment, you will, you know, you might have to show that you're working with the app. That would be a private, you know, semi-private ordering, only semi-private because we're obviously advocating for the government to facilitate the infrastructure. But I think more importantly is maybe the education point from the question that was asked previously. If people believe and come to understand that these public health apps are going to allow them to, you know, see friends and leave the house more often without risking their health, I'm confident they will buy in.
Dahlia, I'll answer your question a different way. Let's get back to the gay South Korean. This is a lot of what the privacy stories or complaints about that system have addressed. It's a real problem that gay South Koreans today don't feel comfortable with that system, and that they might leave their phones at home or they might not get tested when they think they should do so. And to me, what that really illustrates is that a system that doesn't adequately protect privacy isn't going to serve public health purposes, but you can deal with those without relying on user choice. And this is, again, why the key flaw in the South Korean system is that if I am diagnosed as being positive, that means that my location history, but not my name, but my location history is made public. That broadcast makes it possible for my friends, my employers, and my family, at least in some circumstances, to re-identify me. We are not proposing that. We are proposing instead a narrow testing system where if I get tested positive, only the people who I have been in contact with are notified of the time and place of an interaction with a positive person. So we think that a narrow casting system like that tells my friends and family and everybody else who was at that gay bar or club that they may have been infected and to take appropriate measures. So it's smarter, it's more privacy protective, and I think it gets the gay community of Seoul to a point where they actually, A, feel comfortable with that, and they want to carry their phones with them because they know that they will be the ones who benefit. They'll only get that targeted smart notification if the system knows that they were in contact with people at that point, instead of just getting a list of places that were contamination, which is how the South Korean system works.
Thanks, Baron. So next up on the queue is Jolynn Dellinger. If you're still on, you'll be unmuted. You can ask your question.
Great. Thanks to everyone for your presentations. They were amazing. My question is for Jane and Brian. In terms of this more robust contact tracing plan that you're proposing, have you built into the efficacy of that plan the ability to enforce the actions that we want people or assume people will take, which is the self-isolation and quarantining that would follow notification? Because if we don't have that piece, it seems like it's really not working. So if we can't mandate isolation and quarantine upon notification, how will these things help as much as we think they will?
Yeah, so I don't think there was consensus in the group of people we work with on whether enforcement needs to be strong. So I'll let, you know, Baron comment. I fall on the side of, at least until we see otherwise, not using this system as also a system of enforcing quarantines. And that's partly because if we're at the point where, I still have enough faith that people want to prevent the infection of others, to take seriously any notifications that seem to be based on, you know, on a pretty reliable and accurate assessment of risk. And if that's not true, I will be, you know, sort of deeply disappointed as a member of the community. But in any case, at that, I would want to wait until we see, you know, disregard of notifications to the point where we think that we need to actually, you know, get out the stick.
Thanks, Jane. So next up, David. David Seedy, you're in the queue, and if you're still on, you're up.
Hi. Yeah. Thanks to everyone who's participating. Really enjoyed this, and thanks for staying afterwards as well. So I had two questions. First one, maybe not answerable, but I just was interested in whether Baron and Jane would share who the broader group of collaborators were that worked on this project. And the second one is really about placing a lot of weight on technological means of increased surveillance to identify these infected individuals. And the questions I have for that are to do with threats from different kinds of adversaries. So on the one hand, I can imagine privacy-concerned individuals who might protest against this kind of a more heavy-handed regime, both by trying to prevent disclosures, leaving their phones at home, as someone has mentioned already, but also trying to despoil collection with false disclosures. We've definitely seen that with location collection in the past. We've seen people with wheelbarrows full of phones, et cetera, making a point. So it's reasonable to suspect that that kind of thing might happen again and kind of undermine the reliability of this kind of approach, particularly if a lot of weight is placed on it. And I'll just note, you know, that kind of thing can happen and be effective even if only a small number are of a mind to do it. You don't really need lots of people. You just need a few to have a disproportionate impact. And so that, I guess, raises the question about enforcement for participation or for this kind of protest action. So there, I know Jane mentioned something about, for example, enforcement with at the employer boundary. You know, so in order to come back to work, you have to bring your phone. Presumably, you have to not have been shown to undermine the system with a wheelbarrow full of phones. So the point I made was just that enforcement for participation at the work site has a disproportionate impact on people who have to come into work rather than those who can work remotely. And so that kind of approach to enforcing participation in the collection system that was proposed has that problem. Okay, so that's one set of adversaries are these privacy-concerned individuals who might protest it. Second adversary is the state-level guys who might want to manipulate where outbreaks seem to be occurring in a country. That seems like a reasonable thing, and you can fill in the details there. And then finally, sorry for the long question, just the adversaries like insiders. So, you know, I know NSO Group and Palantir have been interested in participation in this kind of system. You might, you know, they have a very wide-ranging set of things that they do. And in general, you know, contractors are a central part of making this kind of system work when it's implemented by government. And so there are going to be lots of insiders with lots of varying interests. So, you know, saying the CDC is the only one who's involved in a centralization proposal is maybe not totally right. It's going to spread to a lot of private industry, and the people with the relevant expertise might be people who raise separate trust questions. And I'll stop there. Thank you.
I don't know if anyone wants to do it. Really, you put a lot on the plate there, David, but we are kind of getting close on time. If anyone has a very parsimonious response to the really good comments from David, that's great. Or otherwise, we have four more people in the queue. And because everyone's been so patient, I would like to try to get the questions if I can. So I don't know if Jane or Baron, if you have a quick, or Woody or Dan, have a quick response.
Well, just on the last part, so all of those points are well taken, and David, we'd be happy to talk with you further. On the last part, yeah, we've kind of anticipated that that there will need to be contractors or, for example, building different apps that would be assessing risk. But we've worked with Adam Marcus, a data security expert, to try to understand how, and some of this is laid out in the paper, how to ensure that the data that's maintained in a data repository kept in a way that that would be accessed by algorithms, but not algorithms for automatic processing, but not, first of all, not decipherable on its own if you were to access the whole database. And in any case, yeah, so we've been trying to build in technological measures to reduce some of the risks, even from insider attacks.
To your point about who was engaged, my former colleague Adam Marcus, a technologist, has been helping us. We'd love to get other people involved who could help think through exactly these kinds of attacks. I know people have been working on that. We don't have time to get into all of them. I will just say two things. One, the way a system of privacy protection works is fundamentally through enforcement, through having strong penalties. We would like to see a penalty system that is at least it takes as its baseline the current system under the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, but that has real penalties for abuse and a well-funded safeguard body that is able to detect violations and ensure that the law will be enforced. And the second quick point I would make is, yeah, you're right, that employers that there's some threat here from employers, but you have to compare that against the baseline. And the baseline is, I think, worse. I think that in a system, in a world without this, you're going to see a kind of contact tracing and testing regime imposed by employers on people who do not have a choice. And that will be imposed ad hoc on a basis, individualized basis from employer to employer without the kind of safeguards that we're talking about. It's also not going to be very effective. So we're proposing a system that essentially means that those employers don't feel the need to and may be legally prohibited from doing this on their own, and that would not give them access to this data. So we're very aware of that problem, and we're happy to think through exactly how to deal with it.
Thanks. Here, actually, Jim Harper was online, but was had some technical difficulties. He emailed the question in, which sounds somewhat Coasean, actually. The question here, what about dropping the mandatory dimension of the program and offering to pay people for participating? It's a natural barometer of privacy interest overcome, and an offer of payment can be tailored based on demographics, et cetera. Again, we could probably spend an hour talking about this, but I think it's interesting. Again, it seems like Jane and Baron, you're the ones getting all the questions directed to you, so apologies, Woody and Dan, but do you want to quickly react to Jim's idea of
Well, I'll just say that the system that we proposed, we really didn't talk about much today, to subsidize devices and data service for every American would be a quid pro quo. It would offer people something in exchange for participating. And our goal, frankly, is just to get the participation number up as high as possible. It really doesn't matter to us exactly how it's done.
Thanks, Baron, for that quick answer. Here's another one via email because of some technical difficulties from Patricia O'Connor. Why is the model based on CDC and federal involvement? Why can't it just be designed at the local level? So I guess the idea here being, the tracing and tracking and the data flows will go to a local authority as opposed to the CDC to a central repository. I think it's a very good question.
Yeah, and actually we debated this, and we're a bit ambivalent, actually. There are some efficacy advantages to having a national data repository because people don't stay cleanly in their states or jurisdictions, and especially in areas where people might live on one state line, across, in one state and work in another. And so we're a little worried about hops or having two different, you know, making people download two different apps because they need to access two different databases. But there are also some advantages to having a federal system where each state or local authority has its own database. But to be really clear, it's only the GPS and Bluetooth tracking data that would be in this CDC repository. It would be up to the states to figure out how it's going to make use of that data to predict risk and to give recommendations for who should be tested, who should stay home. We were even imagining that an app, you know, a really ambitious state could even have an app that lets people modulate how much risk they're willing to take on and that sort of. So we are, you know, anticipating that many of the most important decisions would be made at the state level, but this way they'd have the advantage of being able to grab the data from people who have just entered their state and were previously in another.
And just to avoid any confusion here, you got to think about three steps. There's what happens at the device level, sending the data up. We think that in order to happen, needs to happen subject to a national mandate and privacy protections that go along with it. We think it's better for that to go to a database, so the data is all in one place. Once it's there, it's really up to the CDC or the states to decide how to use that data. And that could be done with a national app. It could be local or state apps. The important thing is that the data is in one place subject to one set of privacy protections. And there is an overall statutory framework governing the scheme.
Another point I would add as a epidemiologist is the idea of the jumps being so important in the transmission. So we get somebody from New York going to a rural area in another state, and those kind of changes are what we need to be very responsive to in order to nimbly and agilely be able to respond to an epidemic and not have to go into broad lockdowns again.
Thanks, Dan. That's great. So I have a couple more in the queue, and again, I understand if those, some panelists have to jump off, but if not, I'm really appreciative of your time and here. So Laura Brandemart, another familiar name. So you're up if you're still on. Go ahead.
Hi, everyone. Thank you. This was a great presentation and great discussion, too, and thanks for staying. So let alone all the adversarial positions that David discussed, I'm more worried about how your suggestion actually improves the current system when it comes to accuracy. I'm sure you're familiar with Alyssa Redmile's work and Esther Hargitay. They ran this very broad survey about people's willingness to use these apps as a function of the trade-off between privacy and efficacy. So people are not, in general, people are not willing to make that trade-off unless they are guaranteed that this thing is actually going to work. But I'm not sure how connecting GPS and Bluetooth will actually work anything in the accuracy, because we know that GPS, of course, is not accurate enough. It's less accurate than Bluetooth, and it has more risks. It exposes people to more risks because we know that we can re-identify people based on their actual locations. So, yeah, I guess the question is, how does adding GPS actually help anything in terms of accuracy? Thank you.
Thanks, Laura. Nice to hear your voice. So if you imagine being a human contact tracer for a public health authority, I think the benefits of having this type of data would start to seem obvious. That the one reason we actually, you know, recommend both Bluetooth proximity and GPS is, first of all, so that they can kind of, you know, we can triangulate and figure out whether people were actually near each other. Because each has flaws that the other doesn't. They also share some flaws, you know, so this is not a system without error, of course. But in any case, as you're trying to reconstruct someone who has ultimately been, you know, what the path was of someone who ultimately tests positive, without having these types of, you know, data trails, it's going to be very gappy. And so if we just imagine what the efficacy advantages are to having, you know, the timing that people were near each other, and the places, it remains to be seen how effective this would be, but I think it's worth trying.
And let me just reiterate, proximity tracing will never identify, at least directly or in an automatic fashion, places that need to be decontaminated, which has been an important part of, say, the South Korean experience. And then just think back to the user's experience. If you get a notification that says you may have been infected and the app only tells you it happened X number of days ago, that notification to you is not likely to be very useful, and you're going to start ignoring notifications. So from the user perspective, we think it's really important that that they be given a smart, tailored, informed notification, whatever fashion that is delivered, whether that's an automated notification or a call from a human contact tracer, that is able to help that person understand the circumstances of their likely infection by telling them it was at Trader Joe's, it occurred on this time, or it was at this place on the street. That information is important. And the way that we propose to deal with the privacy concerns about this, again, is that we, unlike the South Korean system, would not broadcast the location history of infected persons. Only users who've been infected would be told only the information that they need to know about when and where it occurred.
I see Woody has to go to another event. Do you want to say any concluding remarks, Woody, or just...
I just want to say thank you for including me in the conversation. I appreciate it and I enjoyed it.
Thanks, Woody. Seeing you. So the last person on the list, and this is kind of a blast from the past, Sebastian Dingler from Germany. It's fantastic to hear from you, and you have the floor if you're still there.
First of all, thank you very much for the insightful presentations and debate. One thing, not being a privacy lawyer, but having worked now for the last 2 years with many law people, I've been reminded of the fact that even though the perception of the European data protection law is that it's based fully around consent, and that has come up earlier, there is a widespread possibility to not have consent at all necessary. It's not necessary except for the very sensitive data. Now, the question that kind of comes in here is whether you would consider the type of information that you have in your app, because it's health-related, to be that form of sensitive data that maybe you'd get in trouble with European data protection, also whether that would be transferable as an app towards Europe as well in the same idea, or whether there would have to be a special exemption for this in light of a public health exemption.
Agreed. I think I too quickly fell into the usual misconceptions of the GDPR, that there are many routes to collecting and processing data, and consent is just one of them and maybe not necessary. But in terms of what we would analyze to decide whether it's sensitive, I actually think there are two different, with a system like ours, there are two different layers, because the Bluetooth and geolocation data, that's the data that we would recommend collecting without consent. And so that's the data that we'd need to ask, is that sensitive? And I think I think there are arguments on both, especially in the way that it would be collected and maintained, where it uses a series of ID keys that are constantly changing, so that they're kind of, it would be harder to reconstruct who each person is without a key log. But in terms of the apps, at least the system as we're kind of imagining it right now, the states would create their public health apps that then might be reporting, say, your risk score, or, you know, however the notifications are made, it may wind up, aggregating a whole bunch of different data to pop out something that would be sensitive, your risk score, let's say, your risk of having contracted it. I don't see any problem with having people opt in to the, at least right now at the forefront, having people opt into, you know, downloading, having to download that app. The way we designed our system so far is that if you're going to participate in the federal program where you get your cell phone bill paid, well, then you have to you need to opt into one of those public health apps. But if someone just didn't want to and didn't download the app and managed to avoid employers and retailers that require the app, that would be fine because everyone else still gets the benefit of knowing if they're high risk. So if I'm managing a store, If I've come into contact with someone who is high risk, I at least have the information to know that I need to take extra precautions.
And again, that's because you have to break this down in three steps. There's the collection, which happens at the device level, and then that is shared into the database. It's processed in the database, and then the apps are relevant because they present to the user some recommendation. It's a risk score. It may be the specific facts or the circumstances of their infection. It is not in any circumstance the sharing of any individual's full location history. That is absolutely the kind of sensitive information that the GDPR rightly requires opt-in consent for. But I think if you look at what we are proposing, I think it would be well justified, as far as I can understand, the way that the legitimate basis analysis works under Article 8.
Sebastian, by the way, we would love for you to read the full report and give us comment and, you know, jump into our team if you want to. It's really nice to hear your voice.
Yeah, it's nice to hear from you, Sebastian. And I think that that's the last in our queue. We have gone 40 minutes over our allotted time, but that's the great thing about doing these things online is there's no one's going to kick me out of my house, so we can just keep going on. But unfortunately, Dan and Woody have other obligations. They were really kind to stick on the line as long as they did, but they've had to go. I don't know if Jane or Baron, if you want to give a final word, or you think everything's been covered, and if not, we can wrap it up. So I'll leave it to you.
Well, I'll just close by saying two things. This is a multidisciplinary project. Jane and I are both privacy lawyers. Jane is more technically expert than I am. We've had the expertise of Dan and a few other Adam Marcus, a technologist. We'd love to get more people involved, and I'm sure that this idea will develop further as we go along. So if you have a criticism, we'd love to hear it, and we'd love to get your help to incorporate it. And if you want to read what we've written or contact us, the easiest way to do that is to look on Twitter. Our Twitter name is just data versus COVID. That's all spelled out in one word. And you'll see there we've just shared the long version of this paper. We'd love to get your feedback, and you can contact us directly on Twitter through that data versus COVID account.
And I'd like to end just by responding at least a little bit to Woody's big point, which is the lacking in infrastructure and nervousness about the precedent that this kind of system would set. I share those concerns. I also, though, have a concern about the precedent that has been set by mass lockdowns. In fact, one thing that really kind of aggravated me as an academic is seeing the condescension with which people treat the, liberate protesters. I understand the criticism, of course, but those protesters are responding to lockdowns the way that many of us, I think, would respond to a really aggressive, unprecedented system of surveillance. And so it doesn't make sense, I think, to ignore one and prioritize the other. They have to be understood together.
And I just would close, James, by saying this is all about trade-offs. James' point is privacy is never just one value. Even our friends at Epic, the electronic Electronic Privacy Information Center put it very well when they've said that privacy is always something that's traded off against other values. And here the values are not just human lives and the ability to reopen the economy and get people back to work. It's liberty. It's our most fundamental liberty interests of being able to leave our homes and associate with other people and see our friends and family and to protest in person and so on. And those have to be weighed in the balance here. And I think there's a way to do that that allows people to leave their homes to return to the normal lives that they had lived in, or something close to that, in a responsible way, so that if they infect someone, that their trail can be reverse engineered and people can know whom they put at risk, and other people know that they have been put at risk, right? That's the kind of thing that will allow people to reengage in the economy with confidence.
Well, thanks, Baron and Jane, for those closing remarks. And I think bringing it around to trade-offs is a great way, because, you know, here at the Program on Economics and Privacy, that's what we're all about, is to look at privacy from the lens of economics and think about making trade-offs at the margin. So with that, I want to thank both of you and Dan and Woody, who had to leave, for sticking around for an hour and 45 minutes. I also want to thank the audience who remarkably so many have stuck around for this time, so which I think is a testament to how compelling and timely this discussion is. And finally, I'd just like to thank Aaron Murphy and Amanda Olsofsky-Hugh, who do all the work behind the scenes here. None of this could happen without them putting this all together. So thank you guys so much. So with that, we are adjourned. And Jane and Baron, good seeing you, and great working with you on this thing.
Thank you.